Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Training Tidbits podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge from Animal Training Academy, and I'm extremely excited about having you here with us today and being back in your eardrums to talk all about best practice behavior management for what is set to be another amazing episode. I can't wait to dive in and learn all about today's guest and their learning odyssey. If you haven't checked the past episodes out yet, then make sure to head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com. And you can listen to them all there, or you can also find them on iTunes and/or on Stitcher. There is definitely something there for absolutely everyone, as well as some sensational up-and-coming episodes planned over the next wee while. Just before we do get started, though, I want to say a massive thank you to everyone that listens to this podcast on a regular basis, or maybe you're joining us for the first time ever. This show is so much fun to make, and I get really inspired thinking about all the people that have benefited from all the wisdom our podcast guests have shared. Today's episode is, of course, going to be no exception to this. And if you do like today's episode, then please feel free to share it as far and as wide as you possibly can. I appreciate that a lot of you listen to this podcast on apps from your mobile devices and smartphones. And one thing you can do that's really appreciated is navigate to the title of the podcast. And around there somewhere, you'll find three little dots. If you tap on this, it opens up a menu. And one option in that menu is share. So you can easily share it on whatever social media network you use, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, Snapchat. And I would be extremely grateful if you could take a couple of seconds to do that. But we're going to get started now on today's episode, where I'm going to be talking to Margaret Rouser. Margaret has 20 years of experience training a wide variety of animals, from marine to free flight birds to
primates. She has been at the Oakland Zoo
since 2006, beginning there as a zoological manager for the Children's Zoo and Primates. Her responsibilities during that time included serving as the enrichment and training coordinator for the entire zoo, as well as managing the day-to-day operations of that section. In 2017, she became the conservation manager. She currently manages Oakland Zoo's Biodiversity Center, which houses the amphibian conservation programs. Margaret has a BA in anthropology from UC Santa Barbara and an AS in exotic animal training and management from Moorpark College. She has served on AZA's Hamadryas Baboon Advisory Committee and was on the board of directors of the Animal Behavior Management Alliance for nearly 10 years, serving as their secretary, vice president, and also president. She's been passionate about improving animal welfare through positive reinforcement, training, and enrichment throughout her entire career. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Margaret Rouser to the show today. Margaret, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really excited to be here.
I can't wait to talk about the things that we're going to talk about today, Margaret. So the honor is all ours. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your morning to come and hang out with us. So thank you.
Thank you.
Fantastic. We are going to now dive straight into the first question. Margaret, to get us started, could you just please take us all back 20 years ago or whenever it was you started Moorpark and tell us about where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training and some of the first animals you ever trained using it?
Well, obviously my first introduction to animal training and positive reinforcement was at Moorpark College, which is the college in California here in the States. And it was a great opportunity. We had 150 animals on campus and students had the opportunity to learn positive reinforcement training with those animals, but also with some supervision and the benefit of the amazing staff that was there as well. So I had the opportunity there to train a wide variety of animals as is part of the curriculum there. So of course, some of the first animals that stick out in my mind are the primates. I had lion-tailed macaques that I absolutely adored and to this day still absolutely love. And then my first job was at the San Diego Zoo training mandrills, which are primates, of course. So I would say those are probably my two most influential experiences, and then from the beginning of my career. So yeah.
Fantastic. And you're adding to the list of Moorpark College graduates that we've had on this show, and they're obviously turning out some highly skilled individuals. So you went from Moorpark to San Diego Zoo, and you're working with, I believe, one of our past guests, Nikki Boyd.
Nikki and I, we didn't work in the same department, but yeah, we knew each other at that time.
There's our one degree of separation on the podcast show. And
Nikki and I actually know each other best from ABMA because we spent a lot more time together doing that than we did at the zoo.
Yeah, fantastic. And once again, adding to the list of ABMA presidents now.
Yes.
on the podcast show. So there's potentially people sitting at home scratching their head and going, what on earth is a lion tail macaque? Have you got any great stories about your time at Moore Park Board? Maybe an animal that sticks out to you and a funny story or inspirational? Oh,
I don't know if there's any I can actually tell. No, one that sticks out. There are quite a number of interesting stories, but I will say that there was one particular lion-tailed macaque. And lion-tailed macaques are these beautiful monkeys that come from India. And they have very, very dark fur. They're kind of a medium-sized monkey. And they've got long tails with little tufts on the end. But then around their faces, they have this beautiful silver mane. So they look almost like kind of a mixture between a lion and a monkey. They're absolutely beautiful, beautiful, beautiful monkeys. We had three. Sal was the male, and then there was Christina and Tubbs were the two females. And I would absolutely say I learned so much from the three of them. And some of that I carry with me to this day. Some of it training, some of it just the experience of having that relationship with such amazing animals and just feeling so lucky to have such a relationship with such an endangered species. I think that's always been, for me, just having a relationship with an animal, which of course you develop, the best way to develop that relationship is through positive reinforcement training. You know, one of the things I trained Christina, my little lion-tailed macaque, to do was to present her belly for manipulation, ultrasound, that type of thing. And that's a really vulnerable behavior for an animal to do, presenting that belly and that and the chest. But she was great. She was a smart girl, and we worked together and we learned to trust each other and we figured it out. And it was great. It was a great experience.
That's super cool. So training a behavior like that right from the start of your career, definitely going to be putting you on the right road to success. Now, we've talked about Moore Park College numerous times on this podcast and discussed what it is and how great it is. But just because I think it's so valuable, I'm sure some of the audience of this podcast are going to end up at Moore Park. Can you just share one or two sentences about how you would sum up Moore Park College in your time there?
It was the most demanding 2 years of my life. It was also the best 2 years of my life. It was outrageously difficult. It was 7 days a week. We were there 6 a.m. until 6 or 7 p.m. We were there when I was there. I don't think they're doing this anymore. But when I was there, you had to spend the night one night a week. In the summer, it was 3 nights a week. You're the entire zoo. You do every single thing. I've gone more than 2 sentences. My apologies. But I will also say that, you know, I made friends in that program 20 years ago that I am still very close with today. Some of the best friends that I've ever had in my life and probably will always have.
That's fantastic. And I absolutely love hearing about people's behavior odysseys. So thank you very much for sharing that, Margaret.
Of course.
Moving forward, what I'd really like to talk about now is big bucket of a topic, animal welfare. What is animal welfare, Margaret? And how can we examine this using the 5 freedoms model?
Well, you know, that's the problem, is there really is not a good definition for animal welfare. And I think partly because that probably varies depending on the species that you're talking about, what's good welfare for different animals. Historically, we've used the 5 freedoms to sort of measure that. And the 5 freedoms was, of course, introduced as part of the farming industry back in the 1960s. And so really, it's something that really needs to be updated. And as I understand it, Aussies are updating it a little bit, which is great. I'm excited to learn more about that. But in terms of the 5 freedoms, what we've looked at were things like freedom from hunger and thirst, freedom from discomfort, freedom from pain, injury, and disease, freedom to express normal behavior, and freedom from fear and distress. Well, the first 3 are really easy to measure, right? You can tell whether or not your exhibit is clean. You know that you're giving veterinary care. We can provide shade, water, climbing structures, things like that. But the last 2, freedom to express normal behavior, and freedom from fear and distress, are a little more difficult to measure. And typically, we've tried to address those freedoms by using enrichment and operant conditioning. But it's still something that I think, because it's not easily measured, it's something that we haven't put as much of a focus on as we should. And in all honesty, because it's not easily measured, that's why we should put more of a focus on it. The basic freedom from thirst and behavior, freedom from discomfort, that stuff is all easy to address, easy to measure. We need to spend more time on the psychological aspect.
Yeah, and a big saying of mine actually comes from the management area, a guy called Peter Drucker, who was one of the early chief cats at Microsoft. And he said, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it.
Well, but that doesn't mean you can't address it. And I think you can address these psychological welfare aspects. And it just takes a little bit of a shift in thinking. I think we need to shift our focus away from spending so much time on things like cleaning and disinfecting, spending more time on psychological welfare of the animals.
Cool. And we're gonna dive deep into this soon. Just want to just touch on this a little bit more, but just before we move on, it is challenging to define what these behaviors might be for not only the species in front of us, but the individual animal in front of us as well.
Correct.
And that's the problem with any labels, really, when we're thinking about behavior. But it must be quite confusing there, potentially, for new keepers coming into the industry. What's your input on the best way for us to think about these last two freedoms?
Oh, well, gosh, I think it probably is something that's difficult to grasp for new keepers. That being said, new keepers that are just starting out their career are oftentimes the ones that are most open, right? They're sponges. They're absorbing as much information as they can. They're eager to learn. I think those are the keepers that are the most likely to embrace this type of philosophy.
And me and Margaret were talking just before we started the podcast. If you're in Australasia, you might know about a model used in the industry here called the five domains. So just wanted to acknowledge that for all our Australasian zoological keepers. We're going to be focusing on the five freedoms today, though. And we're going to move on to the next question, though. But what we're going to start talking about now is this idea of the physical well-being of the animal versus psychological well-being. Is that an appropriate way to frame this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think... The thing is that they're not mutually exclusive. There needs to be a balance. I think the thing is that as humans, we like to feel like we're making a difference. And I think we have all, as keepers, experienced that, you know, you've scrubbed something and it's super clean and you see that dirty water run into the drain, right? And it's so gratifying because you know you've done something, you've been productive, you've made a difference immediately. Psychological welfare is a little longer of a process. It's not an immediate gratification the way that cleaning is, the way that diet changes are, the way oftentimes even that medical care is. So it's patient type thing. So I think it's a lot harder to get excited about it.
I remember that feeling every time I mow the lawns at home and I look out at the grass, I'm like, it feels so good.
Yeah, exactly. You've got that immediate feeling. And, you know, particularly these days, we've got all these new cleaning techniques. You know, we don't have to use bleach every time. We've got pressure washers. Who doesn't love a pressure washer, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's
I can hear the satisfaction in your voice.
Right? There's, you know, we can steam clean. And then there's all these different types of disinfectants. You know, we used to just have bleach and bleach can be very corrosive, but now we've got the chlorhexidine and all of the other stuff that's a lot less corrosive. And so we can use them more often. And we start to use them more often because it makes us feel accomplished. I don't know, you know, what it's like in the rest of the world, but in the US, the United States Department of Agriculture, which is our sort of overseeing organization for zoos, requires us to disinfect everything at least once every 2 weeks. But I feel like a lot of people do it a lot more frequently. And that's something that I want to address. You know, something that I think maybe we need to back off a little bit from that.
Yeah, we're going to dive deep into this really soon. I've got a ton of questions written down here that I want to address and go through with you. Just before we do, though, just backtrack just a sec. We acknowledge that we all like pressure washing. You can write your name on the ground and all that fun stuff. Right. For me, in my career, and I'm not speaking for anyone else here, I'm just speaking for me. When I was working with an animal and I made progress in a shaping plan, or I know that I communicated in an animal in such a way where I added something to its repertoire that was going to decrease stress and improve our ability to work cooperatively together. For me, I think that psychological feeling that I got was much better than pressure washing. Although I like that as well.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. But again, when you do that, it doesn't happen right away, right? You probably had to do it over the course of several training sessions. Mm. And, you know, particularly for a new keeper who's not as comfortable with positive reinforcement, maybe hasn't used it as much, I think it takes a little longer to get there. But I think you're absolutely right. And we should hang on to those little victories of, yes, I made a difference. And just recognize that, you know, what's more important, you know, that you wrote your name with a pressure washer or that that your chimp now allows a blood draw and you won't have to be knocked down for something simple like that.
Yeah. And one thing that comes to mind here is someone in the zookeeper thinking about this stuff, and the other consideration they have to make is potentially what their managers are seeing. And I know that a nice, clean, super sterile, I don't know if that's the right word, but let's just say clean, exhibit is something that a manager can easily see as well.
Right.
So do you think that plays on keepers' minds when they're choosing whether to train, whether to enrich, or whether to clean?
When we overclean and things are too sterile, that's actually a detriment to the animal's welfare.
Continue.
You know, a lot of animals, scent is such an important part of their repertoire, of the information that they get. You know, there's major urinary proteins that a lot of animals use as scent markers. And the major urinary proteins are what we call involatile scents, meaning they don't change. They are basically an animal's signature. So no matter what state the animal's in, the major urinary proteins are the same. There are also volatile signals. And those tend to be signals that indicate whether or not an animal is an estrus, whether they're receptive to breeding, they potentially have a health problem. And animals need both of those in order to get the information. It's very complex information. And so when we're constantly scrubbing, we're removing information. We're taking it away from our animals. It's, I'm going to joke, but it's essentially like someone constantly erasing your Tinder profile, right? You're, you know, there are other problems. There's the hygiene hypothesis, which is that germs are necessary to develop a healthy immune system. There have been multiple studies done in people and children where the cleaner the environment, the more likely the child is to have allergies. And children who are raised in what we would consider, I don't want to say a dirty environment, but more diverse environment, I guess, in terms of bacteria and things like that. Children who are raised on farms, say, have a lot fewer allergies. Your body needs to be exposed to these things, right? That's why we vaccinate. You're exposing your body intentionally to a controlled amount of a disease in order to prevent you from getting sick if you're exposed to that disease again. Recognize these outside influences. It's going to wind up attacking things that are not harmful. One of my motivations for this particular hypothesis, one of my favorite little otters here at the Oakland Zoo, his name is Wyatt. Super sweet boy. We love him to death. He's a North American river otter, but he is allergic to freshwater fish, which is utterly ridiculous. But if he gets even a bite of, you know, freshwater trout that we're giving to the females, within an hour, he will be curled up in pain. He will be crying. It's a horrible thing to watch. And it's really incredibly ridiculous that a freshwater river otter can't eat freshwater fish. And so we've had to alter his entire diet, where he still gets certain fish, but a smaller amount, and he has to only get a certain type of fish. He gets a larger percentage of the meat that we give rather than the fish. And then, you know, fewer whole fish means it's not as good on, you know, it's harder on his teeth. We have to supplement his diet with thiamine and things like that. So it's just this whole sort of crazy slippery slope that we go down. And I would say potentially maybe if things hadn't been so sterile for him, maybe he wouldn't have this issue. Just a thought.
So that's the hygiene theory you're saying.
That'd be the hygiene hypothesis, which are that humans need to be exposed and animals need to be exposed to a variety of pathogens early on in life in order for your immune system to develop normally and healthily. They're saying is that when this doesn't happen, we start seeing an increase in autoimmune diseases, things like allergies, things like arthritis, things that our immune system is going a little haywire.
So this is formed based on humans and we're...
Yeah. So back in 2002, there was a paper written by Graham Rook and Laura Burnett, and they are from the Royal Free University College Medical School in London in the UK. And basically they're saying that things like allergies, inflammatory bowel disease, other autoimmune diseases, those things are occurring because our environment is too clean. And what they saw was when they looked at children who had the most sterile environments, the families who were super clean, disinfected everything, the more household disinfectants there were in the house and the more use there was of them, the higher the possibility that those children would have inflammatory bowel disease, things like that. And of course, there's this spiral, right? Like your child appears to be sick, so you want things even cleaner. So you get this kind of ugly cycle going. And I suspect that we're doing something very similar with animals. I think that, you know, animals are wild and they're meant to be exposed to pathogens and things like that. And of course, I'm not saying leave them alone when they have parasites or, you know, don't treat them for things like that. Of course, we want to treat them for things. And of course, we don't want them to be ill. But a little bit of dirt is not going to hurt them and could actually benefit them. So maybe we could back off a little bit on the cleaning. And in turn, that may give us a little more time for the psychological welfare aspect, such as the training, the enrichment, all of those things that also give us sort of that gratification. They're really beneficial for the animals, but they may take a little more time than scrubbing and may take a little more of a delayed gratification.
So there's a difference then moving forward and potentially a mind shift that we need to make between sterile and cleanness.
Absolutely. There's a big difference between being sterile and being clean. At the Oakland Zoo, we have developed sort of what we call these matrices, where we look at how much time we're going to spend cleaning and how much time we're going to spend with training and enrichment on a daily basis. And it depends on, of course, the level of staffing that we have. We're very lucky at Oakland Zoo to have a lot of volunteers. So I know not every zoo is that lucky, but there are days that you have heavier staffing days than others. So what we do is we say, yeah, we've got these sort of minimum requirements for cleaning, but we're also going to set minimum standards and minimum requirements. And the training and enrichment is going to become our priority. We're going to do some cleaning, but that's not going to be the first priority. That's going to come second. So instead of saying X amount of time, how much cleaning can I do? And I'll just fit in whatever training and enrichment and the rest of the time. Instead, we're saying we need to do this amount of enrichment and training, we'll see what cleaning we can fit in.
We're gonna talk about these matrices in detail because I think they are gonna help a lot of people. I just want to backtrack a little bit and just continue on our conversation about this idea that maybe we're over cleaning. We talked about MUPs.
Yes, major urinary proteins. Yeah.
So basically, you know, when we think about our dogs, air quotes, marking their territory at the park, what we should be thinking is our dogs are just going around spraying their MUPs and they're in volatile substances.
That's exactly what they're doing. Yeah.
Can you explain this in more detail?
Yeah. So this information is really critical for animals, right? This gives animals information on their health, their sex and reproductive status, where their territories are, predator and prey information, if you know your prey knows if they smell predators around. So this is all critically important information. Interesting things about this is not just that it's critical information, but just how critical it is. And I think we don't realize oftentimes just how important that is. If we think about removing all those odors, we're removing all that information, but what we're not realizing is that we're causing a sort of almost a mild state of anosmia. And anosmia is the inability to perceive odors. So what a lot of people don't realize, first of all, some of the effects of anosmia include altered sleep patterns, deficits in maternal care, elevated plasma and cortisol levels, and oftentimes greatly reduced reproductive success. But what a lot of people don't realize is that anosmia doesn't just cause stress, it causes distress. For example, when pharmacological companies are testing antidepressants, they need an animal that's a model for depression. And in order to induce depression in mice so that they can test, remove their nasal bulb and cause anosmia. And when mice have no sense of smell, they're under chronic stress. And they're used as a model for depression. And their behaviors, their depressive behaviors, can be altered by using SSRIs. So it's not just a stress of removing these. It literally is distress for many of these animals. I mean, I just was blown away when I read that they used bulbectomized mice as a model for depression, and that was how they want, you know, when they need to study a drug that's for depression, they do it by removing the sense of smell out of a mouse. I was blown away. And that really made me think about what are we doing when we're over cleaning? We need to stop removing all of these scent marks. We need to stop removing all of this information from our animals because it could really be causing problems for them.
So the mice were becoming distress. And if we want to bring it back to us and how we understand it, that would potentially be like, audience members, your Tinder accounts being removed.
Yes, that is kind of my funny little way of describing it. But yeah, essentially that's what it comes down to. An animal's major urinary protein, which is part of their urine, part of their scent, is their identity. And, you know, if an animal is looking for mate or even just looking for a buddy or just looking for some information, you know, that all comes from major urinary proteins. And the major urinary proteins are the ones that are the involatile proteins, the ones that stay with the animal no matter what, no matter what's going on in their body. So yeah, I mean, essentially every time we're scrubbing off their scent marks, we're removing their Tinder account.
So the takeaways is these MUPs are obviously highly important, and we might cause anosmia potentially and decrease the ability for our animals to detect scents if we're cleaning too much.
And yeah, it's not true anosmia in the sense that we haven't removed their sense of smell, but we've removed all of the smells that are important to them. And when you're removing all of that information, that can cause depression in mice, which can be altered with an antidepressant drug. So if we know that removing these MUPs, these major urinary proteins, from all of our exhibits, we could be inducing depression in some of these animals.
Very interesting thing to think about moving forward. And the other obvious consideration when thinking about the amount or intensity of cleaning we conduct in a zoo is whatever we decide is going to have an end result on how much manpower we need to achieve this task.
Correct.
So potentially overcleaning, and additionally, if we cleaned less, would free up time for keepers to focus more on psychological elements of the Five Freedoms model, with things like training and enrichment. Can you talk about this idea a little bit more, Margaret, and how we might move forward with this discussion and manage our time potentially different within zoos?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so first of all, I think what we need to do is really start reducing our use of chemicals and disinfecting. We have created a model at the Oakland Zoo where we use what we call cleaning and psychological welfare matrices. And so we have a matrix that will say, here is the cleaning that we do on a day when we're really shorthanded. And it's really the bare minimum, right? It's things like cleaning the food and water dishes, maybe sweeping up. Maybe we don't hose every day. You don't need to scrub every pool every day. Then we also have, this is what we do on kind of a moderate day. And the low day, you know, you don't do that more than 2 days in a row. Again, there's a difference between clean and sterile. We don't want to be sterile. We do want to be clean. You know, then we have kind of a moderate section where we say, this is what we do when we're doing a moderate amount of cleaning. This is what's expected. And we're going to say on that day, that's a day that you have, it depends obviously on the section, but you know, that's a day that you have three keepers as opposed to just two. And then there's a day that would be like a heavy day. And that's when you do a lot of your scrubbing and a lot of your extra things. The majority of the time you're going to do the moderate, which would be cleaning your food dishes, thoroughly hosing your floor, things like that. We also have a second matrix, and that would be our psychological welfare matrix. So I'm going to use, for example, the one that we have for our Malayan flying foxes, our bats, their psychological welfare matrix. On a day when they have a minimal, just one keeper, nobody else is helping them, they are minimally required to have their AM diet divided into three different feedings throughout the day, at least 25% of which has to be delivered through enrichment. Their PM diet will be delivered in hanging bowls, so they have to go through and sneak around and get things, and they must have at least one non-food-based enrichment, which would be something like scent enrichment or something like that. So that is the bare minimum that those bats will receive every single day, no matter what. Now, on a moderate day, which should be the majority of your time, okay, moderate should be how things normally are. Your AM diet will be divided out among three feedings throughout the day, half of which should be delivered via enrichment. They should have at least one training session that includes both maintenance behaviors and new behaviors. Their afternoon diet should be delivered in a combination of the metal and the hanging bowls, as well as other enrichment, and one additional food-based enrichment. So that's going to be what your bats are going to receive on the majority of your days. And then on a heavy day, you've got two keepers and a volunteer, you've got tons of time. Their AM diet is going to be divided out with three feedings, most of which is going to be delivered through enrichment. They're going to have at least two training sessions that day. One can be working on maintenance behaviors, but one of them has to be working on new behaviors. Their afternoon diet will be delivered in a combination of metal bowls, hanging bowls, and other enrichment devices. And we will have at least one additional food-based enrichment, and they will get fresh browse. Everything is written out. So the expectation is really, really clear. And it's also really, really clear that when you have this amount of staff, this is what's expected of you.
Yeah. So the expectation is clear, which helps the keepers. And it also helps the managers, doesn't it? Know that things are getting done and then they're happy that everything's being covered. Can you just talk about that and also just compare, maybe run us through the bat cleaning requirements for the different staff days?
Yeah, absolutely. On a minimal day for the bats inside the night house, their food dishes would get cleaned. If they had previous food-based enrichment, such as, you know, devices or food was in it, we would throw it in a bath to soak. We may not necessarily finish cleaning it, just throw it in a bath to soak. Maybe you can take care of it the next day and just dry squeegee up the floor. So just clean up anything, basically sweep up anything off the floors. And that would be the bare minimum that you have to do. And you wouldn't do that more than 2 days in a row, but it gives the keepers permission to do more of the enrichment. Now, a moderate day, which would be your normal day, right? That would be your sort of your nearly every day. You're going to clean your food dishes, you're going to clean your food-based enrichment, and you're going to hose your floors. Now, on a heavy day, this again, you know, a couple of keepers, you've got a couple of volunteers, all of your food dishes get cleaned, your food-based enrichment is cleaned, you thoroughly hose the floors, you can scrub the floors, possibly with a disinfectant, you can hose off the feeders, and you can clean the ropes, scrape the ropes, that kind of thing. And that should be done at a minimum every 2 weeks, just because for us, USDA requires disinfecting at least every 2 weeks. You know, we keep a little sort of a laminated sheet of, you know, when was the last time this was done? When was the last time this was done? And the keepers just write the date in. When was the last time it was scrubbed? You can immediately look at this sheet of paper and say, oh, well, the last time the night house was scrubbed was September 24th. So I should probably do it on Tuesday. I'm going to plan for that day. The other thing that we want to pay attention to, particularly because of this anosmia, is that you don't have to scrub and disinfect the entire night house every single time, or at least not all at the same time. You can, for example, with our otters, we have four stalls inside the otter night house. You can disinfect one stall and not do the other three, right? Because that allows you to leave those major urinary proteins. So maybe you scrub one stall on Tuesday and then you wait a couple of days and then you scrub the other stall. And that maintain that vital information and those clues that they need.
So what you used in there was permission. And I feel that is a huge takeaway for me when looking at these matrices. You allow the keepers that permission so they don't have to get to work, know they have a one keeper day. And from my experience, I feel like I've known keepers who feel like they just must clean everything every day to a super high level, no matter how many people are there. Yep. And it causes them that, understandably, if you know your co-workers called up sick and you got no volunteers, it causes a significant amount of stress.
Yes.
But this matrix says, no, it's okay. We acknowledge how many people are here today and we give you permission to move forward, get your enrichment and training done and still know that you're doing minimal requirements.
Yes. Yes. And I think it's really important to have that. And I think it, you know, it took a little while for our keepers to get used to it as well, because we all have this idea that cleaning is what's best for our animals. But like I said, we really need to back off of it a little bit. But it is important to give people permission to say, you know what, I don't need to scrub everything every day. I can spot clean today. And then I can spend that time on the enrichment and the training that is so important for the animal's psychological well-being.
So just in case anyone out there thinking, not saying that there is, you're not saying don't clean. You're just saying do it smartly.
Yes.
Take time to create these. And you've shared with me some of these matrices. You have to let me know if it's okay to share these in the write-up or not, because I think it'd be really valuable for people to see those.
Yeah, definitely.
Fantastic. So if you want to see what that bat matrix looks like, I'll include that one. I'll put a link to it in the podcast write-up and you can go and check it out. But you know, back to what I was saying and you're about to answer there, is it's about actually sitting down and just thinking. and putting it on a piece of paper.
Right. Well, and also, again, recognizing that over-cleaning can also cause harm. It's not just, I can give myself a break. It's you're also giving the animals a break. Mm. Over-cleaning can be detrimental to their welfare. You're removing all of this information. We know that anosmia can cause depression in mice. Like, we need to back off on this. And the other part of that is that if we are scrubbing the otter night house, otters are hugely scent oriented. Do one stall on Tuesday, do the next stall on Thursday, do the next one on Saturday, you know, spread it out a little bit so that you don't completely remove their entire scent from their home all at one time. And in fact, AZA, we're several of the taxon advisory groups are recommending that. In fact, the Otter Taxon Advisory Group is recommending that you don't disinfect more than 25% of the exhibit at any one time due to their need for scent. The New World Monkeys Taxonomy Advisory Group is saying that tamarin perching, because they really, you know, scent their perches, you should never re-perch the entire exhibit at one time. Change out one or two perches at a time, but don't completely remove their scent. It's too stressful for the animals.
So we should only remove portions of their Tinder profiles at a time.
Exactly. Exactly.
They still got a chance. They still got a chance to find the love of their life, but it's not
exactly.
And this is really interesting to me, because I just think back and how I thought about this throughout my career. You mentioned that it took a little while for some of the staff to wrap their mind around it. Is this kind of a case of old versus new philosophies, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that that is it. I think also there's just, you know, in general, there's always some resistance to change, right? Change is scary. Change is new. I think the other part of that, that in my experience, is that sometimes when you come up with a new idea and it's big and it changes the way you do everything, people feel threatened, partly because they think, well, now you're telling me I've been doing this wrong for 20 years. And that's not the case at all. I think what I always tell my staff and my interns and everybody is that we do the best we can with the information that we have. And when new information comes out, sometimes we make changes. This is new information. 20 years ago, I didn't know that anosmia caused depression in mice, but now I do. And I'm going to make changes based on that and based on what's best for my animals. So I think a lot of it is just change is new, change is scary, but change can also be positive. And I think as zookeepers, we owe it to our animals to always stay up to date on the most recent studies, the most up-to-date information, and do the best we can based on that information. One of the other things that keepers always want to use their time for, which is always really difficult, is observing our animals, right? I mean, we would all love to just be able to sit and watch our animals. We want to make sure that the enrichment that we're using is effective. We want to know if we really are reducing stereotypies. That's another thing that you can potentially make time for by using these matrices. Cutting back on cleaning so that you can spend half an hour looking at, hey, is this elephant swaying? Is this chimp eye poking? What's going on here? Because if our techniques aren't working, again, we need to change them. We need to look at what we can do to make them effective so that our animals have the absolute best welfare that we can possibly provide.
Yeah, fantastic. Hey, we're going to move on. Thank you so much for all of that, Margaret. It's really interesting. And I know a lot of the people listening to this podcast are going to have a lot to think about moving forward.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
We're not finished yet. We are nearly at the end, but
almost.
That's okay.
Because can't get rid of me that quick.
We're heading into one of my personal favorite parts of the podcast show, and this is story time.
Okay.
Margaret, could you please share with everyone listening, thinking back, two or three stories from your experience training animals, doing enrichment so far, and some of the important lessons these have taught you along the way?
One of my favorite stories, I think you might have heard, was working with our flying foxes. We had, when I started at the Oakland Zoo, we had this group of 30 flying foxes, Malayan and Island, so two different species, and they were all male. So basically 30 boys. 30 teenage boys is what it came down to. And, you know, flying foxes have a very distinct breeding season. And so we would come up on August and they were terrible. They were horrible to each other. And we would have tons of injuries. They were fighting. They were jumping on each other. We were seeing genital injuries, things like bloody rectums, swollen penises, things like that. it was really difficult. And I was with one of my primary keepers at the time, Andrea, and we were in the middle of applying hemorrhoid cream to one of the bats, but he was trained, so he would let us do it. But we were both kind of, it was distressing to us for the animals to be injured. It's hard on us just as much as it's hard on them, because we don't want to see our animals hurt. And I think Andrea joked about getting them a blow-up doll. And I said, you know, a group of Girl Scouts just dropped off all of these stuffed animals. Let's give it a try. So we started putting up stuffed animals, hanging them upside down in the bat night house, as ridiculous as this sounds, but the bats started using them. And we tracked the injuries that year. And then we tracked the injuries the following year when they had their stuffed animals for the entire time. They still fought, but we were able to reduce the number of genital injuries by nearly 90%. So that was a huge learning experience for me, that as much as we were kind of joking about, you know, the blow up dolls and the, you know, teenage boys, you know, whatever, sometimes that is what's needed, is to hang these stuffed animals upside down in the exhibit. And of course, you know, a lot of times your higher up management is like, oh, what are you doing? This looks horrible. It's not natural. And, you know, but we're very lucky. Our CEO is a veterinarian. And we kind of propose this as, well, either we hang stuffed animals upside down in the exhibit, or you invest in hemorrhoid cream. And he went along with the stuffed animals.
So sometimes blow-up dolls are needed when you have 30 teenage boys with half-deleted Tinder accounts.
Yes. That is exactly right.
I really like this story. It shares the importance of ideas, the importance of creativity,
and
the importance of brainstorming. Can we just focus on this a little bit more, just before we move on, because I feel it is so important. The ability for an animal trainer or someone who's providing enrichment for animals to be creative and to say yes to the crazy ideas.
Well, and I think that particular need is not one that we often think of when designing enrichment, right? You think of foraging opportunities and scent marking opportunities and puzzles and things like that. We don't often think about, you know, what literally comes down to sexual opportunities. And sometimes you need to.
Especially when you can get a decrease of 90% of genital injuries. That's huge.
It's huge. And not having to apply hemorrhoid cream to a bat's rectum is the best feeling in the world.
Equal to writing your name on concrete with a pressure washer.
Right. It's a very close second.
Hey, sadly, that does bring us now to our final question for this episode. Margaret, could you please take us all into the future and share with us what you would like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the animal training, animal care, enrichment world?
I would like to see people coming up with better ways to balance their psychological and physical welfare with their animals. The biggest complaint that we all have, and that I always hear, is that there's never enough time to do everything we want. So I would like to see priorities shift. I would like to see a better understanding of the difference between clean and sterile. I would like to see a better understanding of animal welfare. I think there's more research that needs to be done on psychological welfare. And it is starting to become more of a priority, but I would like to see animal welfare become a top priority. And one of the first things that you think of when you think of an animal keeper is that they are managing an animal's welfare rather than just scrubbing something.
And so moving forward, we've got to really become better at managing our resources, managing our time, so that we can influence the welfare.
Yeah, I think, and also a shift in priorities is also going to be a part of that. A shift to more of the psychological priorities. It is more important for me to give enrichment to this animal, for me to extend their foraging opportunities or something along those lines, rather than disinfecting something.
Yeah, I want to be a bat at your zoo on one of those full keeper days. That sounds like fun.
It is a good day, I can tell you that.
Hey, such a great vision. And we are, of course, working really hard to make these things transpire as we move forward over the coming years. As mentioned, though, that does sadly bring us to the end. But before we wrap up, just a couple of things, Margaret. Is there anywhere you want to point people to in the podcast write-up? We can potentially add a plug in here for some really important work you're doing with some highly endangered animals.
Oh, well, you mean my frog work? Is that what you're asking?
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about your frog work. Let's put a link in the podcast right up about your frog work, because we haven't talked about this today, but this is something that takes up a lot of your time. It's super important, obviously, to you and to these frogs. Tell us about that, and we'll put a link in the podcast right up for that.
So what I'm working on right now is the zoo has partnered up with government agencies and universities. And what we're doing is there's Batrachochytridium dendrobatidis, which is this nasty fungus that is attacking frogs all over the world, is running rampant in the Sierra Nevada mountains, which is a mountain range here in the state of California. So these are local frogs for me. And we've lost about 90% of the mountain yellow-legged frogs in the Sierra Nevadas due to this fungus just in the last 10 years. So it's really terrifying. So what's going on is we are bringing these frogs into the zoo mostly as tadpoles, because tadpoles are not affected. They carry chytrid, but they are not affected by the fungus. It only affects the keratinized part of the animals, which would be the mouth parts in tadpoles, which is just a very small part. And so it has very minimal effect on them. So we're bringing them into the zoo as tadpoles. And what we can do is treat them and clear the fungus pretty much the second they become frogs. Then we let them grow up a little bit. So they hang out with us for anywhere from 10 months to 2 years, depending on how long it takes them to grow. And one of the researchers at the University of California, Santa Barbara, has developed a method of inoculating the frogs against the fungus. So once the frogs become large enough, they can go through this process of inoculation before being released back to the Sierra Nevadas. And it's a tight process. It's a very delicate balance. You know, you can't just give a frog an injection. They have tried that. It does not work. There are no detectable antibodies to the fungus when just giving an injection. So what we actually have to do is we've got them in this very rigidly quarantined room with, you know, dedicated boots and clothing and everything. And we give them the disease. Each frog is individually pit tagged, so we can track each individual frog. So we introduce the disease to them, and then we kind of let it fester, so to speak. We do test them by swabbing their skin once a week and sending those swabs out for PCR analysis. There's a critical load level, which is 10,000 zoospores. So we treat the frogs at about 3 weeks or 10,000 zoospores. So they get sick, usually 3 to 4 weeks, and then we clear the disease, and then they go back to the wild. And the idea is that we've allowed their bodies to mount an immune system in advance so that now their bodies can handle this fungus. This project is really very much in its infancy stages, but we do know that in following years so far, they have been able to recapture frogs that have been released after being inoculated. So we know that this inoculation is working at least for the first couple of years. So it's really exciting to be able to be a part of that. It's a pretty delicate balance. I just received 99 tadpoles this past week, all of which are positive for the fungus. They came from an area that, you know, we know has a lot of the fungus. And one of the interesting things too is that this species, because they live in the high Sierras, sometimes at 10,000 feet or even higher, so it's very, very cold, and they will go and hibernate during the winter, and that includes tadpoles. So these tadpoles, it can take up to 4 years from the time they hatch to the time they become frogs because they overwinter for so long. What's interesting is that biologists are going out and they're finding areas where there are no adult frogs because the adult frogs have all been killed off by the fungus, but there are still tadpoles. And so those are the times that I get the phone call where they say, hey, can you take some tadpoles in because this group is going to become extra if we don't. I'm really honored to be a part of that project, and conservation is really another passion of mine. I'm so grateful that we're able to really make a difference, which I think we are doing with this project.
Cool. And glad that we got to talk about this today and get that little bit of passion talk from you at the end there.
Thank you. I have a lot of passions, obviously.
Hey, Margaret, from myself and on behalf of everyone listening, thank you so much for making this time to come on the show today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
Fantastic. And we do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And just a small favor of those listening, if you did enjoy this episode and this podcast show, and as a practitioner of best practice behavior management yourself, you feel that the information held within could help others, then please share this wherever you can on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, Pinterest, Snapchat, Tinder, whatever you use, so that as a community, we can do absolutely everything within our power to disseminate this information as far and as wide as possible. One really easy way to do this, as mentioned at the start of the podcast, if you're listening to it from an app on your smart device, then there should be three little dots next to the title of the episode. This does change slightly between devices and depending on what app you're using. But if you click on this, there'll be an option to share the episode, and you can choose your social media network, and it's done. Super simple. That would be mega appreciated. That's it for this episode, though. We'll wrap it up there. Thanks again so much for listening. For now, it's time to shake, rattlesnake. You'll hear from us again soon.